We finished the 24th chapter on Sunday, and one point that I wanted to make that I ran out of time to make, and it kind of goes along with the theme that we developed when we started the quarter on the Luke, the Gospel of Luke material, which was two quarters ago, and it's listed on page 1 through 4 of the Luke introduction, and then also the Acts section, which we started last quarter, also has the same introductory material. I don't have those page numbers in front of me at this time. But anyway, what I wanted to mention was this two-year imprisonment of Paul at the hands of Felix, as chapter 24 concludes. We suggested in the introductory material that two-year Caesarean imprisonment is one of the more plausible possibilities of when Luke would have written the gospel record. Because Luke was with Paul in prison in Caesarea at this time. And as the points are given by those who advocate that position, which I think has a lot of merit to it, remember how Luke begins the gospel. He talks about how he begins the Acts record, the former narrative account that I composed, O Theophilus. And he talks about how he made a record as best as he could based on eyewitness testimony, though Luke not being one of the eyewitnesses. So being with Paul those 2 years in Caesarea, since Caesarea was close by Jerusalem and Judea and all that area, he would have had ample access to interview the eyewitnesses and write that account. Now again, it doesn't make any difference that we know for certain when he wrote that. But if we try to come to some kind of a conclusion, this two-year imprisonment does offer one of the best possibilities for when Luke did compose the gospel record. So we did advocate that when we began that Luke quarter, two quarters ago, and we've come to that juncture now at the end of Acts 24 when he is with Paul those 2 years. And Felix, of course, as we know, as Luke writes there, left him in prison. For what reason? As 24 concludes. Why did he do that? Yeah, to do the Jews a favor. It was politically expedient for him to try to appease or pacify the Jews. And so he left Paul there. All right. As we suggested in 24 on Sunday, the next three chapters, 24, 25, and 26, Paul is standing before three different men. 24, he stands before Felix. The chapter tonight, who is he before? Porcius Festus, who succeeded Felix. And in the next chapter, which we'll study the Lord willing on Sunday, who is he before? Herod Agrippa or King Agrippa. So tonight we look at his standing before Festus. And as we get to the opening verses of chapter 25, first question is when Festus traveled to Caesarea from Jerusalem, how are the opening events described as Luke begins in these first couple of verses? What happens? All right, the Jews start up with their charges again. This version says the chief priests and the leading men of the Jews were the more prominent Jews. So, as they had done with Felix, they're going to try the same thing with Festus. They're going to start making their charges and their accusations against Paul. They start right in. You get the idea of the way this is worded in 25 and verse 1. Festus, therefore, having arrived in the promise, that would be his initial coming to serve as the procurator or the governor. So he's now taking over and he gets there. 3 days later, they don't wait but 3 days, and the Jews come right in again and start to accuse Paul and bring their charges before the governor. Just don't waste any time at all. And they urged him, verse 3, what was it that they were requesting of Festus? Yes, what was the favor? Now, bring him to Jerusalem. Now, they're in Jerusalem. Festus has come from Caesarea to Jerusalem. Now, where's Paul? He's in Caesarea. All right? So they say, look, bring Paul up here. Now, why was it that they were so interested in having Paul brought to Jerusalem? Is it a better court up there? That ambush is still in play. Just one second, Josh. The conspiracy was back in chapter 23. Remember those 40 men, more than 40, came together and said, look, we're not going to eat or drink until we get Paul taken care of. And so that's been at least 2 years ago, because that was the time that Felix kept Paul in prison. And now Festus has come, and so they're still trying to kill Paul via ambush.
Well, pretty hungry now, Bobby said.
Haven't eaten for 2 years. That's quite a long fast, isn't it? Hunger strike. So anyway, the point is, if you'll get him brought up here from Caesarea up to Jerusalem, we can take care of this matter just quick as nothing, and it'll all be over. Yes, Joe. Oh, I stole your point.
Well, I'm sorry about that.
Oh, he did. Bobby stole your point. Yeah, they got pretty hungry by that time, didn't they? Okay. So they wanted Paul to come from Caesarea to fall into their ambush. Well, what did Festus think about this suggestion of theirs? No, I don't know. And look in the next few verses. I think it's verses 4 and 5. He offers 3 points. What's the first one? And let's take them in order. What's the first thing he says in verse 4? All right. Paul is in custody in Caesarea. He's already there. Second thing he mentions, I'm going there myself from here back to Caesarea. And the third point, you come to Caesarea and make your accusations there. So whatever's going to happen, it's going to happen in Caesarea, not here in Jerusalem. So he makes those 3 statements. And everything's pointing to Caesarea. So this suggestion that the Jews had, Festus is not too persuaded by it. No, it's not going to happen here in Jerusalem. We're going to do everything in Caesarea. Now, when the time came if you want to call this a trial, you'll see that Luke writes that Festus arrives in Caesarea some 8 to 10 days later. He sits upon the tribunal or the seat of judgment, and it's time to have the case heard. And he takes up the case of Paul the next day after his arrival. That's in verse 6. The Jews again, in verse 7, they begin to press their charges quite vigorously, you'll see as Luke writes it. And after he had arrived, the Jews who came down from Jerusalem stood around him bringing many and serious charges against Paul. But what was the problem? They had no proof. It's just all speculation. There's no hard evidence against this. And while they're doing all this charging and accusing, verse 8, Luke writes, what's Paul doing? All right, he continues to maintain his innocence, doesn't he? Verse 8, I'm innocent in all this. I haven't done anything that they're accusing me of. That's how verse 8 is worded. I have committed no offense. 4 things Paul mentions. No offense against what? The law, the Jews, the temple. Or really, this would have been what Festus was interested in, or even against Caesar. 3 things against the Jews, law, temple, and these Jews, or even nothing against Caesar. I've done nothing to deserve the treatment that I'm getting at the hands of these Jews. So that's how the case, if you will, is proceeding so far before Festus. Now, you come to verse 9. The question I'm asking here, this is question 3, was Festus inclined in one way or another? He was. Bernie, what was his inclination? Yeah, I really want to do these Jews a favor. Now, let's think outside the box here just for a moment. Why would Felix, as he was, be so inclined to please the Jews? And now 2 years later, why is Festus so inclined to please the Jews? Why would that have been so important to these Roman politicians? Okay, that's a good point, Josh. If there was civil unrest in Judea and Jerusalem, which of course the predominant population is the Jew, and if there were such political trouble and the Jews started making noise against the Roman governor, it gets back to Rome, well, whose neck is it? Would it be his? So, That was the group of citizens that the governor, procurator, would want to make sure is politically pleased the most. So, even though they have already come to him earlier with this request about having Paul brought from Caesarea to Judea or Jerusalem, and Festus didn't buy any of that, he wasn't going to have that, he still wants to do them a favor. And so the way verse 9 reads, after the Jews make their charges here in Caesarea, and Paul offers his innocence and his defense, verse 9 simply reads, Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, answered Paul and said what? What was his question? Now, Paul, would you like to go to Jerusalem and stand trial before me on these charges? Well, what would have been the favor that Festus would want to grant? That ambush. I think that's it. This seems to somewhat show that Festus is willing to accommodate that plan somewhat. Because the way Luke records the verse, he asked this question for the sole purpose of trying to please the Jews. No other reason. What reason would there be to have Paul brought to Jerusalem? There's no reason. The tribunal was there in Caesarea. That was the headquarters, not Jerusalem, it was Caesarea. That's where the governor lived. That's where he held judgment. There'd be no purpose in sending Paul to Jerusalem other than to grant this request. Maybe there's some bribery going on. That's entirely possible, Freddie. Because again, what was Felix wanting those 2 years from Paul? What was business as usual with Roman politicians? Let's grease the palms of these guys to get our way. So that seems to be what he's inclined to do. Well, that's the question to Paul. Will you be willing to go to Jerusalem? Well, look what happens next. Paul halts the entire episode. He brings a screeching halt to it. Notice what he says. Four statements we can get from verses 10 and 11. Let's take them in order. What's the first thing Paul says? Okay, John says, I'm where I'm supposed to be. I'm standing trial before Caesar's tribunal. And that's not in Jerusalem. That's here in Caesarea. That's the first thing he says. Second thing he says is what? I have done no wrong to these Jews. How does he qualify that? And you know this, Festus. Right? This is knowledge to you. You don't have to be convinced of this. This is public knowledge. I have done nothing that these men are accusing me of. Right, that's his second point. What's his third point? All right, he says, if I have done anything deserving or worthy of death, what was Paul's attitude? I'm not going to fight it. I don't refuse to die. If I am as bad a guy as they're making me out to be, and worthy of death, then I will not fight that in any way, shape, form, or fashion. And then the fourth statement he makes is what? No one can hand me over to these Jews. Therefore, what was his trump card? I appeal to Caesar. Could any Roman citizen do that? That was their political right to appeal to the emperor. And Paul plays his trump card, if you will. And so he says, if nothing can be proven, and it can't, then he says, no one can hand me over to these guys. I'm making my appeal to Caesar. I don't think the Jews expected Paul to react that way. And I don't think Festus expected that either. But that's what Paul did. And that was his fourfold statement, if you will, that day when he's before the Jews. Yes, sir. Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good question. Bobby's asking, for a citizen to make this request, Rome's a long way from Judea and Samaria, Caesarea area. And, of course, there's always ships going back and forth. The trade routes were always open, except, of course, in the winter months when there's no travel. But other than that, there's always vessels coming and going. But passage has to be paid. And the question is, I wonder if a citizen could do that, and of course if they're in prison, I wonder who would put that bill. Maybe the government would. I don't know. Being a prisoner, who knows? But Paul is making his case on that fact, that he can make that appeal, and he did. And there wasn't one thing the Jews could do to stop it. It's out of their hands now. And what about Festus? Not only could he not stop it, but as we'll see later in the chapter, what's his role in this now? I've got to send something to the emperor, because if I come up looking like a fool in this and have nothing to accuse him of, I'm going to be wasting the emperor's time and it's going to be my head. And I can't have that, so he's in a real dilemma now. Festus is. He's in a real bad shape here. Okay. The thought question, end of question four, and I put in quote marks, what civil principles, what some basic principles we can learn, I think, from Paul's response. I think there's at least two that I think a disciple can turn to Acts 25, and particularly verses 10 and 11, and we can learn some things that are still valid for us today, even though this happened so long ago. Number one, if a Christian violates the law, I mean, if we break the civil law, even something as egregious as murder, and we've done it, just like Paul says, if someone has done something that is deserving of death, all right, those civil procedures must play themselves out. And if we have exhausted all of our legal means and recourses and all that business, and we're found guilty, what should our attitude be? Just what Paul says. You take the punishment. We don't need to fight that. And I'm saying that because, and again, I'm not here tonight to disparage attorneys. That's not what I'm saying. But there are some legal shysters who will try all kinds of shady tricks here and there to get their clients off the hook. But we live by the principle, what do we learn from Romans 13, basically, and other passages like that? We have to obey the law. That's what God expects us to do. And if I have taken someone's life, if I've committed a capital crime, whatever that might be, then I need to take full responsibility for my actions and not fight that after all my legal options have been exhausted. I think that's the principle that Paul sets forth here. That was his attitude. And that needs to be our attitude. Yes, Joe. Did you have a question? Okay, never mind. Second principle is the Christian has the right to avail him or herself of full protection under civil law. That's what Paul did. Now, where is our true citizenship? Philippians 3. We are citizens of the heavenly kingdom, and that's where our primary focus is. But we don't live there yet. We live under civil law in somewhere on the world, whether we're citizens of this country, a democratic republic. We may live in England under a monarchy. We may live somewhere else in the world if we're a New Testament Christian under some other form of rule. Whatever our government is, whatever our civil rule is, the Christian has the right to avail himself or herself of that... pardon me. That was annoying. I'm leading singing tonight, so that's my thing went off there. Sorry about that. We have the right to full protection under the law as citizens of that country. And Paul did that. He appealed to Caesar. Nothing wrong with that at all. So I think we learned at least those two principles. Being a citizen somewhere in the world under some civil rule. Okay. Well, Paul has made his defense. And verse 12. Festus conferred with his council. He heard what Paul say. We've got to kind of huddle up here, so what was Festus to say after that? Well, okay, my hands are tied. So, see, that has thwarted the Jews now. That's totally cut them off. It's out of their hands now. And Festus had no choice but to honor Paul's request there in verse 12. And this appeal to Caesar would bypass the Jews and this ambush, but more importantly, what does it set in motion? it gets Paul to Rome, which who told him? The Lord had said, you will witness for me, you'll testify for me at Rome. And this will set that in motion. And we've made this comment before. Paul has always wanted to go to Rome, hasn't he? He has said so in the epistle we've already surveyed. He told the Roman brethren that, I do want to come to you. He's always had planned to go to Rome. But I don't think Paul envisioned he would go to Rome this way, as a prisoner, but as a free evangelist. But he's going nonetheless, and he will now be on his way to Rome. Yes, absolutely. We'll find that Paul even did some things that he probably had envisioned on the trip to Rome, both on the ship and on the island they got shipwrecked on. So that's right, Bobby. Providence will lead us in ways that are yet unknown to us. But we can always do something for the cause of Christ. Okay, so having made this appeal, and that set that in motion, now we kind of shift gears a little bit in the chapter, and we are introduced now to two other main characters. And that would be who? King Agrippa and Bernice. And again, I made mention a few moments ago, as chapter 25 begins, the way Luke writes this, by inspiration, this is Festus' first coming to his new governorship. He's arriving to, you know, sort of take the job. And you come to verse 13, several days have elapsed since Paul makes his appeal. And in what appears to be just nothing more than a courtesy call, King Agrippa and Bernice come, and as Luke writes in this version, they come to pay their respects. They come to call on this new governor. That's just the political thing to do. When someone takes office, let's go call on Festus. And so they do. And I'm asking the question now, as we noticed on Sunday, we answered the question, who was Drusilla? Well, who's this Agrippa? And this is question number 6, the last part of the question, top of page 134. More than one Agrippa. Well, which one is this? King Agrippa the Second. All right, who was he? Yes, son of the Agrippa the First, and he was back in Acts chapter 12 that had beheaded John, brother of James. And what happened to Agrippa in that chapter we studied a long time ago? He became very prideful about his appearance. And the crowds heaped upon him all this praise and said, it is the voice not of a man, but of God. And he ate that up, and he was beset with worms and died. That was a judgment from God. This is his son. This would also then make him the great-grandson of Herod the Great, who was the Herod that sought to kill the baby Jesus in Matthew chapter 2 and also Luke chapter 1. Somebody know how he's related to Bernice? Was Bernice his wife? Bernice was not his wife. Bernice was his sister. And they lived in incest together. That was one of the great tragic rumors in the Roman Empire. We had said before on Sunday that Bernice and Drusilla were full-blooded sisters. It appears that Agrippa was Bernice's half-brother. Not full-brother, a full-blooded brother, but her half-brother. But they cohabited in incest nonetheless. So he's living in sin also, just like Drusilla was, being married to Felix in adultery. This is no better. This is just as immoral as the other was. But that's who this man was. And so they had come together, and during their visit, we come now to verse 14. Luke writes that while they were spending many days there, what does Festus do? Yeah, he says, I've got this case before me. I've got this problem. And why do you think, I think we know why. The chapter will conclude and tell us why. But why would Festus have troubled Agrippa with this case? He's wanting help. That's right. Maybe somebody can help me find something to write the emperor about this. And so I'm open to any suggestions by anybody whatsoever. So he begins to describe this case, doesn't he? Of course, Agrippa's not... wasn't there when all this happened, so he's going to tell Agrippa about it. So how does he begin to present Paul's case? This is verses 14 to 21, the major bulk of the chapter. What are some of the things that he says? All right, this is a leftover from Felix. My predecessor, 2 years ago, more than 2 years ago, he had Paul in prison. And when I came on the job, Paul was still there. So I'm having to clean up, in essence, having to clean up a mess that was given to me. All right, that's the first thing he mentions. Then what does he say? Yes, go ahead. All right. Now, these Jews, they have been accusing him vigorously on more than one occasion, right? Not only with Festus, but with Felix, too. I mean, they have been at this for quite some time here in the Caesarea region or area. So, he has been vigorously accused by the Jews, and you see that through verse 15. At the end of verse 15, he tells Agrippa what the Jews were wanting, a sentence of condemnation. Execution is what they wanted. Well, what did Festus say he told the Jews based upon this accusation? Well, Paul had the right to. All right, just like it's one of the foundations of our jurisprudence system. You have the right to meet and face your accusers. Well, he says, I acknowledge to them that that a Roman citizen had the right to face and answer their accusers. And so I set in motion that process where Paul would stand before me in trial and the charges or the prosecution would present their case and Paul would have a chance to make his defense. That's just legally how it works. And so he acknowledges that before Agrippa. And then verse 17, he says, after they had assembled here, I made no delay, but on the next day took my seat on the tribunal and ordered the man to be brought. And so they begin to make their accusations. Verse 18. Then what does Festus acknowledge? The end of verse 18. I didn't hear what I thought I was going to hear. Festus, and anybody who'd have been in his position, the charges were not as I expected. They were not civil in nature. But rather he says, what? It's about their own religion, and specifically what does Festus say? It's about Jesus, and how does he describe Jesus? Some man that had died, but Paul claims he's alive. Now, as a Roman who's not even remotely interested in Christianity, what do you think Festus thought about that? That's right. What am I going to do with this? This doesn't make any sense to me. He didn't believe in the resurrection. It made no sense to him. But that's what this charge was. And so they're spending all this time before my tribunal making these charges, and Paul's making his defense. And in Paul's defense, he's preaching the resurrection of Christ. And so Festus is like, I don't know what I'm going to do with this. This is so illogical to me. So he admits, I'm at a loss. This gets us to verse 20. This version reads, and being at a loss how to investigate such matters, I asked Paul if he's willing to do what? Go to Jerusalem and there stand trial on these matters. That was my idea. But Paul did the unthinkable. Well, Paul, he refused to go to Jerusalem. And not only that, but he also did what? He appealed to the emperor. And that's in verse 21. And so I ordered him. Festus says, I ordered him to be kept in custody until I send him to Caesar. Now that's the rendition that Festus gave to Agrippa. And that's pretty accurate. I mean, it's not spun one way or the other. It's pretty truthful. It's pretty accurate as to what happened. And so that's the story that he told him. What did Agrippa say? I'd like to hear this myself. And so Agrippa requests to hear Paul personally. Now, when he said that, what do you think Festus thought? We know what he said. Do you think he liked that idea? Yes. Anything that anybody can do to help me figure this out, I'm all for it. And so he said, well, you'll hear him tomorrow. I can arrange that for you, no problem. So verse 22, tomorrow he said, you shall hear him. He was glad for that, I'm sure. Give him some answers for how this is going to work out. Okay. Well, as we come to the last part of the chapter, 23 through 27, we have the arrival of Agrippa and Bernice to this little ceremony. How does Luke describe it in verse 23? With great pomp. Fanfare. Any other versions use a different word other than that? Pageantry. Pomp and pageantry. You just can imagine probably the trumpets were blaring or whatever it was, and everybody dressed in their finest robes and official garments and whatnot, and probably had some official line for them to walk through. And in fact, Luke even mentions in verse 23, he mentions the commanders accompanying them into the auditorium. So it was done properly and upright. And so they come in and they take their seat wherever that was, and the commanders were there, the prominent men of the city are there, and so Festus is now going to talk, and as the governor, this is his show, so he has to be in charge of this. And look what he says. The words of Festus, he commands Paul to be brought in now, verse 24. Festus said, King Agrippa, and all you gentlemen here present with us, you behold this man about whom all the people of the Jews appealed to me, both at Jerusalem and here, loudly declaring that he ought not to live any longer. But I found that he had committed nothing worthy of death. And since he himself appealed to the emperor, I decided to send him. Well, that's not entirely correct. He was forced to send him. He didn't make any decision at all. Yet, I have nothing definite about him to write to my Lord. That would be the emperor, Caesar. Therefore, I have brought him before you all, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after the investigation has taken place, I may have something to write. For it seems absurd to me, verse 27, in sending a prisoner not to indicate also the charges against him. And that's true. He'd be in a world of hurt before the emperor if he had nothing to write. Let me ask the question. And this gets us back to let me find the place for just one second. Well, I guess it's verse 25. Well, it was also early, but it's in verse 25. What did Festus know about Paul's situation? He's innocent. He doesn't deserve what the Jews are clamoring for. Okay. Now, what could Festus have done? And for that matter, what could Felix have done? Turned him loose. Who's that remind you of in the Scripture? Pilate. That's right. He had the authority and the power to set Jesus free. Now, of course, the Lord had to die. We know that, but from the Roman perspective, or from the governor's perspective, he could have set him free. And that would have ended the whole situation. But again, Pilate and Felix and Festus have all shown themselves to be political cowards, haven't they? Giving in to the Jews and their bloodthirstiness. So this whole thing with Paul could have been over. Festus is convinced there is no need to execute this man. He hadn't done anything wrong. The difference between him and these Jews who are accusing him is matters about their religion. And again, how did Rome usually react to matters of religion? They stayed out of it. Yes, whether it was the Jews or anybody else. These are your matters and we'll leave them to you as long as you don't create civil unrest in the city or in the province. So Festus could have done that, but he did not. This this dilemma he mentions in 25, the last part of verse 25 to verse 27. He has appealed to Caesar, but he has done nothing to write the emperor about why Paul will be sent to Rome. Is there a benefit, other than the fact that Agrippa wants to hear this case, for whatever curious reasons he had, but would there have been an advantage or a benefit for Agrippa to be hearing this case? Pardon? That's what I'm saying. What would the advantage for Festus be in Agrippa hearing this case? Somebody to share the blame with? Maybe. Herod is a king. Okay. He's maybe transferring some of the pressure to Agrippa. What about the Herods? Not just this one, but all the Herods. What do we know about them? They knew the Jewish law. They were from Edomites, or Adumea is where they came from, but they fancied themselves as followers of Judaism. Now, of course, it was not faithful. They didn't live as faithful Jews. But they knew the Jewish law, and they followed it somewhat. And the Herods also then knew something about Christianity. And this is skipping ahead just a little bit, but as we know from chapter 26, what was one thing that Paul said about Agrippa? Look at verse 26. What did Paul know that Agrippa knew? Well, and verse 3. Yes, Paul was happy to make his defense before this man because Agrippa knew some of these things that Paul talked about. Felix had been gone for 2 years. Festus gets here, and this whole thing is just dumped in his lap. What does Festus know about Jesus? He didn't know anything. What does he know about the way? What had Felix known about the way? He had known something. But he knew more than Festus knew. Festus knows nothing. Agrippa knows something about which Paul is speaking. He's not a Christian. He's not a faithful follower of Christ, but he has had exposure to it. And so I'm just saying, from Festus' standpoint, he has to be really glad that Festus is hearing this case. He can provide me something that I can put on paper. Yes, Felix did tremble. Festus is totally unmoved by all this. I mean, it's not even concerning him whatsoever. Nothing. He doesn't care about any of it. Yes. Yes, Agrippa does have an interest in hearing this, for whatever reason that it was. But we're just simply saying, as we bring this to a close, when he says to Agrippa, his words, especially in 26 and 27, that reveals Festus's dilemma. He is really in a bad shape here. Because he cares nothing about Paul's innocence. That's obvious. He cares about one thing only, and that's his own neck. And I've got to send Paul. Paul's already sealed that. I mean, I've got to send him, but I've got nothing to write. And so Festus, having some knowledge about this, hopefully will provide Festus the little means, if at all possible, about what to send with him when he goes to the emperor. All right. Yes, Albert? Yes. Yes. Very good point. Paul has not been able to preach freely for 2 years. Now, I'm sure he's had some influence. People could come and go to him while he was in Caesarea in imprisonment. But he's not been moving freely about preaching. But the Jews' hatred and their opposition has not diminished one iota. That's a good point to make. Yes, Brother Miller. Well, no, because he did even with Felix when he was the governor. Yes, and that's the right of a Roman citizen. So when accusations were brought, he had the right to meet his accusers and make his defense. Felix gave him that right, and so did Festus, and that was his right to have. Charles, put your hand up a few moments ago. Yes. I think this is Nero. Some sources say this is Nero. Let me look into that and see what we can find. And we'll try to start class with that on Sunday as to which Caesar this is that we're talking about. That's a good question to ask. Which Caesar is this that Paul will stand before? So we'll leave it at that, and we'll pick up there on Sunday, the Lord willing, with Acts chapter 26. Thank you for your participation.